Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project, where every 2 weeks we look at the two movies from the A24 filmography. And as always, charting the films of A24 with me is Dallas King. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Yeah, so we've kind of got an interesting sort of double bill this week where I've seen neither of these films before. So this week we're going to be looking at Equals and Into the Forest. So have you seen any of these films before?
No, I haven't seen either of these films before, although for a second, it has to be honest, I thought we were going to be watching the musical Into the Woods and then realised that I'd gotten the name wrong. So...
Sadly, no music this week. And I suppose this is, for people listening, this is a bit of a behind-the-scenes chat for sort of our listeners, but we're recording this episode sort of 2 weeks before it actually drops because we're going to be so busy covering the Edinburgh Film Festival. So any news that we have here is going to be sort of out of date, and I'm sure there'll be plenty to be breaking in sort of the next few weeks before this episode drops. But we've discovered this week we're not the only ones covering A24 news. Laura Ingraham took the night off paying lip service to Donald Trump to cover the A24 HBO series Euphoria in her Seen and Unseen segment with Raymond Arreo. So the show stars Zendaya and is a look at life for a group of high school students as they grapple with issues of drugs, sex and violence, and this is what they had to say on Fox News.
All right, Raymond, first I need to get this warning out about this latest HBO show. Tell us.
Yeah, well, it's called Euphoria, Laura, and it's targeted to teens. It bills itself as an edgy, true-to-life depiction of growing up today. But in reality, it's a boundary-pushing, graphic sex acts, nudity, violence, crazy drug use among young people. It's sort of the old girl show on crack. The show features former Disney star Zendaya in what is a play for tweens and high school kids. This show is so graphic, I really can't even describe the events here, Laura. But one cast member was so disgusted by the content and the sexual adventures that were introduced into the script, he walked off the set. HBO's bosses were concerned about the male nudity in the show. And if they're concerned about it, you know this must be bad. What my problem is, as a parent, you're pushing boundaries and you're establishing as normative these deviant sexual behaviors, yeah. Transgenderism, gender fluidity, ridiculous drug use, and passing it off as normative. Now, Sam Levinson, Barry Levinson's son, created the show, this guy spent time in and out of rehab up until he was 16. Of course, this is normal for him, living an elite Hollywood life. You know, this is not normal for American kids. It shouldn't be.
I think I got rid of HBO after The Sopranos.
You and me both.
I was like, yep. Oh, my God. It's just not something I care to pay for. I'm not going to pay extra for it, and I'm not going to allow it in my home.
Well, this show is
almost any TV
this
anymore.
This is beyond pushing the envelope. It goes so far.
This is an agenda, and they're pushing this agenda. We're going to be hitting this in the coming weeks and months.
So at the time of recording, this show premieres tomorrow, June 16th on HBO. Have Fox sold you on this show, Dallas, on this miniseries, or are you going to be joining Laura Ingraham on the picket line?
Careful now. Down with this sort of thing. No, it has to be said. It makes me more excited to see it. You know, it's that whole reverse psychology thing. Maybe they are wanting to people to see it. But yeah, no, I mean, initially, you know, when you hear the description, if any UK listeners are listening to the podcast, it does sort of sound like the US's version of Skins, which, you know, actually was really good in the sort of first couple of series and has actually launched some major talents. But so I'm interested to see where this goes, and you know, for A24 to be branching into the sort of the TV series, because it was Rami earlier this year as well, so it's, you know, we've got so much to be watching at the moment, it's difficult to be throwing another couple of TV series into the mix, but I'll definitely make time for them, depending of course how you can watch them in the UK legally, of course.
Absolutely. I know there's no UK date yet, which is frustrating, but what was it like for you sort of seeing A24 sort of pillared on something like Fox News? I imagine for people like A24, they thought, oh my God, this is like the best publicity we could ask for.
Yeah, no, I think it is. It's they probably got their noses in a wrinkle over stuff like Moonlight and all that thing as well. But you know, A24, I guess now they've really made it. You know, they're in the big leagues now. If Fox News are wanting to try and take them down, so. Long may their run continue.
Exactly. I know, I couldn't believe it when I sort of woke up on, I think it was the Friday morning or something like that, and they had put out sort of a tweet just going, Laura Ingram just learned the Euphoria HBO penis count cannot compute. And it was just, you saw that and I thought, oh, I've got to find this video. So when I kind of checked it out, and as you kind of hear on the audio there, they're just so over the top about it. It's like everything about this show seems to absolutely offend them. And I wonder, like, obviously this hasn't aired yet, and you can imagine sort of screeners have been sent round to some critics, how these two sort of managed to stumble across it, or whether they're just making sort of base assumptions about it. It'll be interesting to see how their over the top reaction actually lines up with Euphoria itself.
Yeah, I think what is realistically has happened is they've read the synopsis or something like that, or they've maybe seen like the trailer and have got their knickers in a twist, because 20 odd years ago, was it, in the UK, there's a television show called Brass Eye. And if you aren't aware, it's a guy called Chris Morris who did like the Day to Day and sort of Four Lines and stuff like that. And there was an episode, it was like a fake sort of news show where it was doing reporting. And there was one which was a paedophile special, which was going on about the issue of paedophilia in the UK. And there were all these sort of MPs and stuff like that, you know, basically, you know, ripping the show to shreds and how it was such a terrible thing, until it basically, when probed on it and questioned on it, they admitted they hadn't actually seen the show. They were just going off of what people had said. And it kind of feels like maybe Fox News are going down this thing. They haven't really given it a proper chance, and they're just needing something new to shout about, you know, to distract from Donald Trump's latest faux pas, probably.
Yeah, most likely. I'm definitely curious. Like, I'm sure in some form or another we'll maybe review some of the A24 TV shows and stuff, because none of them seem to ever really get sort of airplay here in the UK. It's I don't know why it doesn't sort of ever translate over.
Yeah, I don't know, but I mean, I think Fox News are actually not the only ones that have A24 have fallen foul of. I think last week or something they'd tweeted out a poster. It was advertising Midsummer, but it was done in the style of like a Coachella festival sort of gig. It had like names of all these acts and whatever, and then it disappeared, and it seems due to a copyright issue. So basically, I don't know, they'd sailed too close to the wind in their branding for the Midsummer Festival, that someone at Coachella got upset and it felt it impinged on their copyright and trademark, so it was taken down. But again, you know, that just plays into the A24's marketing hands and gets people talking about their film more than, you know, people would have already.
I've got to ask you that. So obviously this episode is just going to drop just like a couple of days before Midsommar is released. And we were sort of talking about the hype machine for this movie sort of building and building in our last episode. I feel like it's, I don't know what it's like in America, but it seems so big for it here in the UK at the moment. Like Love Island, HBO, sort of A24 and Love Island have very little crossover apart from perhaps myself and a few others, but like prime time slots, they are advertising that movie. You know, I was just picking up a ticket earlier today for the Maradona documentary, and like the cinema has like posters, the digital art poster sort of Florence Pugh from the movie. And it's rare to see sort of an A24 film like this get such a big push sort of in the summer spell. Obviously we had Hereditary last year, but this one, they seem to be going all out with weeks to go on this film to get hype going for it.
Yeah, no, I think, correct me wrong, I think it's Entertainment Film who are distributing it in the UK. So they've clearly seen it, they clearly love it, and have got really high hopes for it. It's positioned well to be that sort of counter-programming sort of thing against sort of Spider-Man. It releases sort of the same week, same weekend as that. You know, obviously, you know, sometimes it won't always work out, as we saw with Booksmart. It was sort of going up against sort of Rocket Man and Aladdin as the sort of, you know, quirky alternative sort of small budget film that you should go and see if you don't fancy any of that. So, but I think, you know, the fact that I think on the previous episode I said that, or maybe it was Filibuster, that I'd seen the trailer for Midsummer in front of Late Night, which was such an odd choice to see it. But, you know, there's clearly, they're getting it into the right places. There's going to be a lot of hype for it, you know, because I don't remember Hereditary actually being all that big in the UK. I know there was definite fans of it like us who were championing it, and Toni Collette for an Oscar, which never happened, sadly. But, you know, the Oscars don't know anything, really. But, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see how this one sort of ties up. I think it's got more of a European feel, certainly, because it's set in Sweden like that. So there's definitely a market for that, I think. And I think someone also compared it. It look like a very odd sequel to Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, you know, with the Swedish thing. So, you know, I think it'd certainly spawn countless memes at the very, very least. And yeah, I'm still excited to see it, but I'm now sort of going on a sort of media blackout, I think, during the festival, just to avoid sort of hyping it up too much myself, because, you know, there's always the potential for disappointment.
Absolutely, I'm sure in our next episode we'll share briefly our feelings sort of on the movie. But for today, we've got kind of two very different movies, ones that, as I say, we've never seen before. So we went into these movies, they didn't have the publicity of something like Midsommar. But first up, we have Equals. So directed by Drake Demarest from his own story, and it's produced by Ridley Scott, of all people. The film stars Nicholas Hoult and Kristen Stewart as two people diagnosed with a disease that restores their human compassion and emotions in a dystopian world where emotions do not exist. So Dallas, what did you know about this one going in, or did you go in completely blind? And did it match your expectations, or was it a bit of a disappointment?
Well, I wasn't really aware of too much of this film sort of going in. It was one of those ones where when you get the initial list for when we started the project, it was right, I'm going to have to IMDb that one. And then I was like, okay, it kind of rings a bell, but I don't think it ever really screened in cinemas up in Aberdeen for me anyway. Maybe like a couple of days, or maybe a week at most on split shows somewhere, but it's not one that I was really au fait with and sort of was rushing down to the cinema to see, despite, you know, the cast, because I think Nicholas Hoult was great, and Kristen Stewart, as we've said already many, many times on these podcasts, is a huge underrated talent and someone that, you know, people need to forget the Twilight thing and actually get on board with her actually being a fantastic actress. And you know, reading about it, you know, it was like, okay, you know, it sounds interesting. I'll give that a watch. And yeah, I mean, for me, sort of looking at it, it kind of felt like a bit like Logan's Run meets Romeo and Juliet, which, for reasons which we can discuss in a bit later. But I always find it interesting with films like this that you've got sort of two sort of near future sort of dystopian worlds. You've either got the everything has gone to shit and it's sort of rubble and everyone's sort of living sort of hand to mouth and sort of this kind of sort of thing. Or you've got the everything is very clean and everyone walks around in sort of white jumpsuits and stuff. So this is clearly that version of it. And yeah, it was one that, you know, this idea that you're not allowed to show any sort of emotion or you'll be sort of put into a camp or basically encouraged to commit suicide, because emotion is what led, certainly what it's hinted to have led to the collapse of society, and so therefore they don't want that again. But I have to say that I found myself not really having any emotional connection to the film and find it almost rather unengaging in wanting a bit more, and I think for reasons which we're getting to discuss. But what did you make of it on first watch?
Yeah, this was one I was kind of looking forward to, because sort of when you do these sorts of projects, you sort of look ahead, right, going, oh, I know the Ladybirds, I know the Moonlights, American Honeys, whatever. Whereas this one, you think, oh, I like sci-fi. I really like this kind of acting crew. Yeah. And you start to think to yourself, I wonder why this one hasn't kind of broken through. And as we sort of discovered, you know, I don't think there's ever sort of a year where you think with A24, oh, this is the year where it's like hit after hit after hit. There's always movies like this where it felt they kind of sandwich in between some of the big names. And I was kind of really excited to kind of check this one out. I didn't have the greatest expectations going in, because I thought if it's that good, it probably would have kind of filtered through to me. And I just didn't have much of a connection with it either. Like, I wanted to like it more. And I think it's sort of 101 minutes or something like that. It overstays its welcome a little bit, that even sort of as they sort of begin to discover their emotions and break free from that, they're not the most engaging characters, that it just feels like it's a hard sell at the beginning, that these characters are so emotionless, kind of bland, that they have some interesting things going on in their life, but it's a struggle to really get invested in their kind of journey. It's kind of like, okay, oh, well, that's kind of nice for them and happy ever after. It just didn't do much for me. And I think the big surprise for me was I didn't realize until the beginning, until we saw the Scott Free logo, that Ridley Scott was even sort of involved in this movie. That was the real surprise in the movie.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that either, but I guess the sort of white jumpsuits make sense given sort of Prometheus and stuff like that. It does have a kind of similar feel to it, and you know, Guy Pearce pops up as well, so you know, there is that. But I think, like you're saying, what the problem is with this film is when you start a film with an entire society and these two characters in particular who are not in check with their emotions, and when they start to become more in touch with their emotions, they still can't let on. And most of the scenes initially between the two of them, even though there is apparently this attraction, happen in a public forum. It makes it difficult for the audience to connect with that because we're not seeing their full range of emotions being shown. You really need to be able to emotionally connect with the characters. And with that sort of disconnect, which is part of the plot device, it then makes it more difficult for the audience to connect. And I think that's where the struggle comes from, which is, you know, disappointing given the fact that this is a sort of Drake Durham's, his previous film, sort of Like Crazy, had sort of chemistry and romance in spades between the two leads, between sort of Anthony Yelchin and Felicity Jones. I thought they were fantastic in that film. So it's interesting to see it sort of go the complete opposite way and have sort of two people who really didn't have, you know, much of an emotional connection, even when they were meant to be sort of in love and stuff like that. And, you know, it's certainly one that I'm sure if people sort of turned on and said, oh, you know, it wouldn't do the Kristen Stewart is, you know, a terrible actress, sort of on much favours, because it's probably not her best performance in some of the films. It's certainly no Personal Shopper. But, I mean, there was an idea here. It did have potential. I just think it was maybe executed in the wrong way. I'm not sure.
When you were watching this, did you sort of think to yourself, maybe this had been adapted from a book or a comic book or some sort of short story? Or did you kind of get the impression this was an original story?
I'm not sure. I wasn't sure, yeah. I mean, it has got that sort of feel that it could have been based on like a sci-fi novel, sort of maybe written in the sort of 60s or 70s with this idea of the future. You know, you've got all this stuff about, you know, Planned Parenthood, about, you know, people sort of are chosen, you know, to become parents and stuff like this, but basically based on their genes and stuff like this. So you've got that sort of Gattaca feel as well. It kind of had similarities to that. So you can see touchstones for other sort of science fiction things that unfortunately probably do it slightly better than this one, I think.
You talked about sort of a Romeo and Juliet style relationship. Did you sort of feel engaged in sort of the romance in this? Were you invested in that?
I wasn't really invested in the romance of it, but when it gets to the sort of final third, and sort of spoilers coming for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, when it goes down the route of... Basically, I mean, if William Shakespeare was still alive, I would suggest that he maybe look to sue the makers of this film, because what you've got a situation is Kristen Stewart's character is going in, she's been captured and she's been put into this camp because she turns out that she's pregnant and she shouldn't be, because that's not allowed. So what these people do is essentially the nurse character, again, there's a nurse character, which is exactly the same as Romeo and Juliet, basically conspire to basically fake her death in order so she can escape and be reunited with Nicholas Holt's character. However, Nicholas Holt's character finds out that apparently she died and commit suicide, so therefore he decides to take the cure to basically rid himself of the emotions, or essentially commit suicide to his feelings. And it's only when he gets back after doing this that he finds out that, oh no, she is alive. And then they've got this terrible moment where they both realize that they sort of might not be able to be together as they once would. And I was just sort of thinking, this is completely Romeo and Juliet. And you know, it's in that particular moment I could see the quality of the actors and their connection finally sort of came together. But for me, it was just a bit too late in order to save the movie, I thought.
Yeah, I was the same. Like, me and you, we love talking about how we're big fans of Kristen Stewart, and like, people should, oh, you know, people that maybe sort of only know her from Twilight and maybe her reputation, like, oh, she's starring in all these brilliant films, as you sort of say, like Personal Shopper. So I was kind of like excited to dive into this one and go, oh, here's gonna be another one that kind of just, as again, it'll prove that she is a great actress, people should check it out. And it's an A24 movie as well, so it's bound to bring something unique to it. But I was the same as you. I was like, Like Nicholas Hoult is such a great actor, you know. Even something like recently, like The Favourite, we got to even see a brand new side to him, a real kind of comical side. And it was just like with this, they were like, I just wanted them to sort of come out of their shells. And when they do, in sort of that final stretch of the movie, you're like, oh, you know, great talents here, but you know, you could have had anyone really for sort of that first two thirds of the film and sort of those roles. It just felt kind of disappointing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was sort of reading, as always we do with these things, we sort of read on IMDb trivia about it after I've watched it. And, you know, you read that the director apparently wanted these two actors specifically for it and apparently wouldn't have made the film if he couldn't have got them. So it's interesting to see that he wanted these two actors who are capable of fantastic things, but then not really giving them enough to do to prove how great they are. It was unengaging, and unfortunately, yeah, just a bit of a disappointment for me. I'm thinking that this could have been like one of those great finds that you discover on this podcast. You know, there's been a few so far, but unfortunately, this isn't one of them.
One kind of final thing I want to check with you about this film. Like, we've both mentioned we are keen to visit Japan as soon as possible. And quite a lot of the film was filmed in Japan and then in Singapore. What did you make of sort of this futuristic landscape? You know, so many of these places are in futuristic LAs and New Yorks. What did you sort of think about the use of Japan and Singapore in this? Do you think they used it well, or did it sort of not register with
you?
To
be honest, it didn't really register all that much. I mean, there is certainly in the last sort of 10 years, there's been this huge sort of shift, you know, actually even all the way back in sort of like 1982 in Blade Runner, there was that sort of LA fusion of sort of Eastern, Western cultures. Sort of Firefly's done it similar as well. But in the last 10 years, you had Her, which was, you know, shot in Singapore, I think, as well. And you've got this, there's a lot of money sort of coming out of China and stuff like that in order for sort of tax breaks for filming and whatever. So there's a lot of films, particularly of a sort of sci-fi futuristic nature, that sort of weave the sort of Asian element into the story in order to be able to film there and stuff like that. But to be honest, I didn't get a huge sort of Asian vibe off it enough to justify it sort of being there. It could have been shot anywhere as long as it had some greenery and a really sort of interestingly futuristic styled architect designing the houses. So
you've given me the greatest opportunity here, because if you want futuristic greenery, here we go. So our next film today is Into the Forest. So it's set in the near future as two teenage sisters, Nell and Eva, played by Evan Rachel Wood and Ellen Page, live in a remotely located home with her father in a forest. There is a massive continent-wide power outage that appears to be part of a region-wide technological collapse. The two sisters must learn to survive on their own in their isolated woodland home. So the film is written and directed by Patricia Roseman and adapted from a novel by Jean Hegland. So, Dallas, this is another first-time watch for you as well. What did you make of this one, and what did you expect going in?
Well, like I said, I was initially potentially expecting a Stephen Sondheim musical, but it was clear from the outset that it was not this film. This was going to be a sort of tough survivalist sort of thriller. And, you know, the cast, especially, you know, Ellen Page and Evan Rachel Wood, I think are fantastic. And it's really all about the relationship between these two sisters. I mean, it's one of those sort of, and I think like Green Room we had a few episodes ago, where basically within the sort of opening 15 minutes, you've set up the story that, you know, they've got slightly futuristic technology in terms of like glass tablets and things like that. And then there's a power outage in that sort of great way. There isn't really too much of an explanation as to why. It's just purely the plot set up. And then 15 minutes you're in, they're having to survive with, you know, no power. They're having to sort of learn to fend for themselves. You know, the father's there, but I don't think it's much of a spoiler. I think you could tell pretty early on that the real dynamic is between these two sisters. So there was going to be a plot device to get the dad out of the way. And indeed it comes in quite a brutal, grisly way. I mean, this film does not shy away from the more extreme and harsher aspects of trying to survive in a world where there is no power and electricity and stuff like that. And yeah, no, I was pleasantly surprised by this film. I mean, I had no expectations going in, knew pretty much nothing about it until I stuck it on the DVD player. And yeah, and I was pleasantly surprised. even though, you know, at times it maybe felt for me like one of those episodes in the middle of a season of The Walking Dead, where, you know, it's not about the zombies, it's about how they're adapting to their new form life. But as always, it just proves time and time again that in situations like this, men are just the worst. They're just shits. What about yourself?
Yeah, this was a surprise to an extent for me. So I kind of knew about this movie a good few years ago now, 2015. I don't know about you, but sort of my part of my film tradition at the end of the year, David Elric, about sort of early December, he's sort of a writer at IndieWire, always releases like a video montage of the year, you know, his top 25 films, and it uses music from the films of that year. And I like Cat Power, but I don't follow them sort of religiously. So the song he used to wrap up his video, I think it was sort of covered, you know, the footage of something like Jackie, was Wild as the Wind by Cat Power, a cover of the David Bowie song that opens this film and is used at various stages of the film. And I was like, oh my God, that is a beautiful cover. And it's become one of my most listened to songs on sort of Spotify. And I think it's brilliant music. So I was kind of like, oh, what film was that used in? And I found out it was this Into the Forest, and it was like, right, that is noted on my list to check out in the near future. And I never got round to it until we started doing this one, so I'd completely forgotten about it when I put on the film the other week. And Evan Rachel Wood's dance into the song, I was like, oh my God, here we go, finally, after sort of 3-4 years, watched this film. And I really enjoyed it as well. Our other podcast, Filibuster, I recommended this film as well, worth checking out. If you'd watched sort of the latest series of Black Mirror and you were bored shitless about technology and, oh, it's all the devil, and you want something that is just sort of cathartic like this, I thought this was, you know, a nice anti-Black Mirror, just like two women sort of getting by in sort of their home. And I liked how it didn't play up on sort of the usual survival tropes that we do see some elements of, like, how we're going to get enough food and drink, and those things are played up a little bit, but it's sort of more focused on sort of that relationship. And I think that third act, when, as you say, all men are shit, it, you know, it was a really uncomfortable moment, and sort of it really took the film up to that next level. And it was a real surprise film for me. And I think I was further surprised when I read afterwards that it was actually adapted from a novel. I never realised that. I don't know about you.
No, it was something I found out online as well. And it's one of those sort of chance things that, you know, that how this film came about, that Ellen Page was in a Canadian bookstore, and the person in the bookstore recommended this book to her, and then she loved it and then got the rights and then sort of produced it into a film. So, I mean, yeah, it's one of those so little miracles it's come about, but it's a good thing that it has.
Yeah, I kind of couldn't find much information really about the book, but one thing I discovered was that it seems a somewhat difference from what we got with the film, was that the reason sort of the power outage was due to a nuclear holocaust. So in this film, it's more ambiguous that is it a power outage, what's happened. In the book, it seems to be that it was a nuclear holocaust that caused it. So do you think Into the Forest could be better, no different, or worse if it had been sort of a nuclear blast that caused this technological collapse in the film?
I like the fact that it kept it ambiguous. I mean, I think there's at one point they have a solar powered radio, and there's someone sort of saying it was maybe sort of terrorism or something. Terrorists have been and sort of targeting these sort of power grids and stuff, and then there was an overload. I think maybe it's, you know, just maybe could be a slight on humanity in itself, where they're just basically, we've been so reliant on power that you basically overloaded the grid and, you know, have doomed ourselves. So, you know, there is that sort of naturalistic sort of vibe to it, environmental sort of message perhaps behind it all. So yeah, it could be that, but I preferred it being ambiguous rather than being, you know, news reports everywhere that, oh, you know, it was a nuclear holocaust and stuff like that. I like the fact that it left it up to your imagination as to why this had happened.
You sort of mentioned Ellen Page there, so her and Evan Rachel Wood make up the key cast of this film. What did you make of sort of the sisters' relationship in this film and the performances from the two? Did you believe them as sisters, or was it something that you just didn't quite work for you?
No, I really did actually believe them as sisters. I thought they had a great relationship, and, you know, they go through the highs and the lows, and, you know, certainly from the moment that the dad exits the picture. I mean, I find their emotional responses to it and the actions that they take to be very believable in natural sense. And you believed everything that they did and the reasons to why, you know, they wanted to do. At one point, you know, they're talking about leaving, and then, you know, they decide against it, and everything that they do, you kind of believe in their relationship, and everything comes from their characters anyway. And I thought they were fantastic. And what about yourself?
Yeah, I like them. I really like Ellen Page, and part of me often feels that we've let her down as an actress, that, you know, she was one of the biggest properties of the mid-2000s, and, you know, she appears in roles since, but I want to see her in more films. I think she's such a great actress, and Evan Rachel Wood, I remembered seeing her for the first time in 13, and it seems that really in the past years she's, you know, become such a huge name. And even something random, like I was watching the TV series What We Do in the Shadows, and she pops up as herself as a vampire. She's an excellent actress, and getting these two together in a film was really good. And I really liked that relationship, and I liked how both of them, they did go through such a journey in these films, and you could sense that. I was at points I thought, oh, is this maybe going to drag on a little bit, you know, isolated within a home, very rarely going out. But I felt that their characters' journeys made it kind of really engaging, and, you know, to see her go through something so traumatic at the end and really make it into a positive experience as best she could was excellent, and a really brave choice.
Yeah, no, so Ellen Page, I think you're right that I don't think she's been served as well as in terms of really truly great roles that showcase her abilities since, you know, there was like Juno, and also for me, Hard Candy is just a fantastic film, a very difficult film to watch, but she is utterly magnificent in it. And yeah, Evan Rachel Wood is every bit her equal in this. And yeah, it's like you say, it's like, can it sustain that sort of the proportion of the story in that you need things to be happening? I mean, you just can't have two girls sort of sitting in a house for 90 minutes. You know things need to happen in order to move the plot on. And there is that sort of really tough, sort of horrific rape scene. And I found it interesting that I thought it was actually really well handled by the director, and that it basically didn't really show it. It showed Evan Rachel Wood's sort of reaction to it. And I found that really sort of powerful, and it sort of really sort of got into the mindset of the character with that. And then it sort of, with everything that's going on in America as well, I found the sort of arguments the two characters were having over sort of keeping the baby and stuff like that was very interesting. And what was going on, and that, you know, she was like, you know, it's not his fault, you know, a life's a life and stuff like that. I found it very interesting, given, you know, this was filmed in 2015, but given the current situation in America now, I found it very interesting that it's gone down that route, and it's become sort of more sort of topical almost as a result.
Definitely. So have you got any kind of final thoughts on our films for today?
Well, I do have one final thought, and it was something that came out completely out of left field, and I was not expecting it until sort of about the second or third line that he spoke, and I realised that's what he's going with. Max Minghella's Irish accent. Shall we talk about that? What was that about?
Yeah, absolutely. The film history is paved with terrible Irish accents, and this one might has joined that pantheon of films.
Because what I couldn't understand is why the character had to be Irish. There is no reason for the character to be Irish, but somewhere along the line, either the director has said, or maybe it was in the book, or Max Minghella's gone, you know what, I've got an idea, I'm going to play this as Irish. And everyone's gone, okay. And yeah, I mean, at times it might be all right, but it's just really, it took me out of the film, to be honest, whenever he was on screen. And that is not what you want, certainly with an accent anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a mixed bag of an accent, yeah. There, but I'm sure there'll be plenty more terrible Irish accents to discuss in future cinema episodes.
I'm sure that accent needs to get out of the forest and into the bin. Hey.
Definitely. So on a brilliant note like that, next up we'll have Morris from America and Sea of Trees. So Dallas, I've not seen either of these films. Have you seen them?
No, I haven't seen either of them. I think basically my first real experience of actually brand recognition of A24 is probably coming out in a couple of episodes when we start to reach sort of American Honey and sort of Moonlight, that's when I really became aware of them as a company. And I think that's when people started to take notice of them. So again, yeah, this is a couple of unknowns, but excited and to see what we've got coming.
Absolutely. So if people want to check these episodes, you can always find us on Spotify, iTunes, you know, leave us a review if you feel we're worth it. A 5-star review is always appreciated. And thank you very much to everyone for listening. So we'll join you in 2 weeks for more from America and Sea of Trees and some Midsummer reaction. So see you in 2 weeks. Bye.